Beth.
Good morning, Carl. Finally.
Yes, good to hear you, in spite of some technical difficulties, which we don't have to tell our listeners about.
Right.
Welcome to A Life in Biography.
We're
going to be doing something a little different this time, for listeners anyway, not for you. We're going to be talking about a work in progress, a biography that they can't actually buy yet, but once they hear about it, they're going to be so excited, they're going to have to buy this biography. So we're going to talk about Clifford Odets. Maybe you could say a little bit about yourself and how you got to writing about Clifford Odets.
Well, it's a very long story. I'll try to
put it in a nutshell. We have some time.
Okay. I spent most of my life in theater as a theater practitioner, as an actor. My BA is in acting. In theater from Bennington College. I have a master's in drama and theater studies from National University of Iowa. And I have a doctorate in English with an emphasis in theater history. And I did my doctoral work on Odets, which was entailed a roundabout route, which I won't go into, but I'm very glad it did because it has set me off on such a rich and exciting journey. And, you know, I hope not an endless one, although it sometimes feels that way. There's so much in, you know, the period of history in which he lived. And it's for me personally, it's tremendously engaging, both as a former actor and, you know, from an academic standpoint.
Oh, sure. Suppose you're talking to someone who doesn't know about Clifford Odets, and you're explaining that you're writing this biography of him. What would you say?
Actually, I frequently find myself in this position. He was an enormously important playwright who surfaced abruptly in 1935. He was important because in both a political and a theatrical sense. Politically, because as many people, but I unfortunately can't say most people know, the 1930s and the 1940s and the 1950s in this country were extremely turbulent politically. He was important also because he was a Jewish playwright, and his first full-length play, Awake and Sing, was the first play to be produced on that took place exclusively in the home of a Jewish family here in New York in the Bronx. And that was a big step forward for the Jewish population, which, you know, was very firmly entrenched in show business, but was also interested to some extent, not so much in theater, but in film, in masking itself, in assimilation. And again, from a personal point of view, this is in some ways a history of my own family, especially on the paternal side. So working on Odets, who so many people at the time identified with in terms of who he was, where he came from, his family history, and the way he was writing, which came very much from the streets, in a very polished and forceful way, it blew people's minds. He literally blew people's minds. He changed. He changed the course of American theater in many ways, and it was partly because he was a member of the group Theater, which to this day is regarded as, you know, the most important ensemble theater that ever existed in this country. He was also hugely famous, internationally famous, and that transpired all in the first few months of 1935. And it was both extremely exhilarating, as one can imagine, and it was also extremely damaging to him as a young artist. And, you know, I'm focusing on that a lot in my book. It's a journey that so many artists take and are not necessarily elevated by constantly. You know, it's the old American story of fame, fortune, and depression, and you know, a slow decline.
Now, you mentioned Awake and Sing. Say something about another, I think, really exciting play of his, Waiting for Lefty.
Oh, I know you want to talk about Waiting for Lefty. Everybody does. It's really his most famous play, and it's his most frequently produced play. Waiting for Lefty, and there are many reasons for that. One is that it's short. It runs about 45 minutes. It was the first play of his that was produced. It was not the first play that he wrote. In fact, he wrote Awake and Sing, and his second full-length play, Paradise Lost, it was not quite finished, but he wrote most of it before Waiting for Lefty hit the boards on January 6, 1935. And that was what brought him to international attention. Waiting for Lefty is essentially a one-act play in a number of episodes. The way it was produced at that time, it had a couple of extra episodes that are no longer done or are rarely done. And it's based on the structure of a minstrel show. And many people don't realize that minstrelsy was extremely popular in this country. When vaudeville started to wane, minstrelsy did too, to a certain extent. I mean, movies took over everything. However, Waiting for Lefty has an immediacy that no film could ever have. It's set in a strike meeting, a union hall, and you know, the union leaders are of course pushing to strike, and the company men are trying to dissuade workers from striking. And of course, 1935, he wrote it in 3 days in late 1934. And at that time, you know, they were not in the deepest part of the Depression, but there was plenty of labor turbulence going on. And many people were, you know, still picking through garbage to find, you know, something edible. Just the very first lines of Waiting for Lefty are so entirely Odetsian. It's like an explosion. It's like a bomb hitting the stage, and there are plants in the audience which at the time was not a prevalent device. It was prevalent death somewhat in the workers' theaters, which were really thriving in the early part of the 30s. It was not done much on Broadway. And I can't read any of these early plays without tears coming to my eyes, because they're so full of life. It's a shock. As many times as I've read these early plays in particular, I'm tremendously moved. And people, even today are very moved by Working for Lefty. It ends with the words strike, 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 strike. It's an activist play. It's an agitprop.
I have to say, I'm a little surprised at myself that I've never written a biography of Clifford Odets. And now it's too late, and you're doing it. I discovered Odets when I was in high school. I can't remember exactly why, but I read Awake and Sing, and Odets is about awaking. That's what Lefty, as you just said, is about. I was in a suburban high school. I had grown up in Detroit, but then my family moved to the suburbs, to Warren, Michigan. And I was in a brand new high school, all white. And we had a combination, believe it or not, sort of cafeteria auditorium. And I got it into my mind. And there was no one to talk to about these things except my drama teacher. I decided to put on a production of Waiting for Lefty. And I tried to get my fellow students aroused with this play, to get them to think about the 30s and, you know, what their life was like. This was 1964. It wasn't very successful, but Odets's power to wake readers and listeners and theater goers with Awake and Sing. I wrote an Odets like play, which unfortunately is lost. Not that it was any good, but I'd really love to see what I did at, you know, the age of 16 with Clifford Odets. It's a play set in the Bronx, Awake and Sing. And yet it spoke to me because it was about the home. You know, what happens inside the home was such a revelation to me that literature could do that, I guess.
I'd like to tell a story about Awake and Sing, and then I'd like to go back to Waiting for Lefty.
Sure.
Odets is so often criticized or dismissed as being dated. And when a rare production of one of his full-length plays is done, no matter how awakening and, you know, excellent the production is, there are always some reviews that go, well, yeah, but, you know, it's dated. NATCO, which is the National American Asian Theater Company, did a production in 2013 of Awake and Sing. And I interceded for them with the Odets estate, who didn't want them to do it. Their mission is to provide Asian actors with the opportunity to do roles that they will otherwise have an opportunity to do. So obviously this is Asian actors doing Awake and Sing, which is, you know, overtly a Jewish play. Though it's not about being Jewish, it's, you know, the undercurrents, the inflections, the lifestyle or of a a lower middle class Jewish household. Anyway, they did a production on Walker Street down in Soho, and it was so excellent. It was so moving. I mean, talk about blowing people's minds. This was in 2013. Mia Katigbach, who is the artistic director of NATCO, got an Obie for her portrayal of Bessie Berger. In the summer of 2015, the Public Theater picked it up, and acting was somewhat different. It garnered tremendous attention, respect, and I have to mention the director, Stephen Brown Freed, who is wonderful, deserves a lot of credit. Anyway, I was asked to do a talk back at the end of the performance with the director. And I had invited down from Boston a young actress friend named Lisa Wen. and she's Vietnamese American. And I wanted her, you know, to meet the company because she's, you know, hoping to build a career. And so she did. And we were sitting in the, you know, the play had just barely begun. And she, I got the sense that she was, you know, wiping her eyes and blowing her nose. And I thought, oh my God, what, you know, poor Lisa, what is going on? And at the intermission, she was trembling. And I said, Lisa, are you okay? Do you want to go outside? She said, no. She said, I don't ever want to leave here. She said, this is my family. I'm watching my family on stage. She said, it is the most one of the most emotional experiences of her life. And she couldn't stop crying. Now she got through the rest of the play, but she was so shaken, you know, and I was so shaken and so deeply moved at the relevance, you know, at the universality, for want of a better word, of, you know, renowned Jewish play. And it just, you know, to me, that was the proof of the pudding that Odette's is not dated. There have been so many layers of misconception and prejudgment, you know, slathered on top of him and his work, and that's largely what I hope to dispel in my own work.
I wonder if I had this experience with Lillian Hellman. If you ask academics about her, they might use the word dated, at least about some of her plays. They would use words like middle brow, and essentially, you know, dismiss it because they don't consider it literature. And yet I've never met a theater professional who thought anything like that about Lillian Hellman. And she continues, of course, to get produced all the time. And I wonder if that's just as true with Clifford Odets among people who actually are in the theater.
I would say 200%.
Yeah.
Theater is multidimensional, and that's what people often forget. You know, there are so many layers, performative layers, that the playwright's words have to cut through. That's not the best way to put it, but that are channeling the text of the playwright. It is such a collaborative effort. Yes, plays can be read as dramatic literature. They have always, you know, that's always been the case. But there's another level of life. A play is never, I shouldn't say never, because Ibsen did not actually write his plays to be produced. He called them books, but they you know, sure make great theater. A playwright is dependent on the different factors of a production. And I did, when I was planning on writing a later year's biography rather than a full life biography, I spoke to a number of directors about and actors about their experiences of working on Odette's. And, you know, there was nothing but the deepest respect and excitement when discussing working on Odette's. And I interviewed Bartlett Scheer, who is probably the preeminent interpreter of Odette's in this country. He directed the revivals of Awake and Sing, which won a Tony Award, and Golden Boy in 2012-2013, which, you know, also won many accolades, and both productions were masterful, tremendously exciting. And I spoke with Daniel Fish, who is best known for his recent Tony Award for his production of Oklahoma. He's a very innovative director. Not that Bart Scheer isn't innovative, but Daniel Fish takes it to a whole nother level of experimentation. And they all say the same thing, and the actors as well, including Tony Shalhoub, who played Papa Bonaparte in Golden Boy. They all say that the best training for Odette, and who Odette reminds them most of, is Shakespeare.
Hmm.
The language, the construction of the dialogue. Tony Shalhoub, whose role in Golden, Papa Bonaparte, is not a huge role, but it's a very important role. And he was just amazing. And he spent a lot of time backstage and in the wings. And he said that sitting in the wings, listening to that play roll through its performance was like listening to a symphony. And he never tired. Actors, Walt Odette's son, has told me he generally, has some part in the Lincoln Center revivals. Actors have literally gone down on their knees and kissed his hand.
Hmm.
Which makes him laugh because he says, I have nothing to do with this. I didn't write this play. But people are brought to another level, often brought to another level of their work, of their theater work in working on Odette's. My experience with Waiting for Lefty was, as an actor, I was doing my Meisner training at the time, and many actors will tell this exact same story, but it's life-changing. I was assigned the scene between the Edna Jo scene. I mean, this is typical of many acting classes, depending on what technique you're studying. And what I experienced was that with Odette's, you don't have to act much. You are acted upon. And this happens with Shakespeare a lot too. The language is so infused with urgency and blood. It's like you supply the arteries and Odette pumps the blood through. It's an amazing feeling, and I had a huge emotional breakthrough saying the lines, if I may, if I can find it. I know this. Your boss is making suckers out of you boys every minute. Yes, and suckers out of all the wives and the poor innocent kids who'll grow up with crooked spines and sick bones. Sure, I see it in the papers how orange juice is good for kids, but damn it, our kids get colds one on top of the other. They look like little ghosts. Betty never saw a grapefruit. I took her to the store last week and she pointed to a stack of grapefruits. What's that? She said. My God, Joe, the world is supposed to be for all of us. Now, what is dated about that?
Yeah. And imagine that being presented in a lots of neighborhoods in this country.
And it was, the Federal Theater Project did it all over the country, which is one of the reasons why, Congress closed down the Federal Theater Project. It was the first WPA program that they closed down. For being too left-wing. It's dangerous. This is dangerous stuff in a capitalist society.
And so how are you going to capture this notion of the performative text in your biography?
It's not easy.
But, or you'd be done, right?
You know, but Odets wrote so much, and especially, well, any of his plays, any of his productions, you know, whether considered good, bad, or whatever, they're written about them, and not only by reviewers and theater critics, but, you know, by fellow theater practitioners. For example, I have a letter from Tennessee Williams that he wrote to Odets after the opening of Clash by Night in 1941, which was not well received at all. And Williams was very upset. You know, he said, there is some amazing, he said, I was deeply moved by this play. And in many ways, I think it was better than the previous play, which was Night Music. You know, he was so much on the national scene, and, you know, by presenting that and the reactions of well-recognized and brilliant people, I hope that people will get it. And not only that, of course, I have to excerpt, you know, snatches of dialogue, as one always has to do, I feel.
Yeah. Will there be actors' voices in the biography too?
Actors' voices? From my interviews actors?
Yeah.
Yeah. I had kind of forgotten about some of these wonderful interviews that I had done, figuring there's just not going to be enough room because this is turning into such a massive project. But I'm realizing now, partly through discussion with other biographers, that that's invaluable stuff. And I do now plan to interweave those comments, those experiences as best I can, you know, in with my descriptions of the productions and the reception of the productions. And because his relevance today is of the utmost importance, I feel, especially, you know, the incredibly divisive times that we're going through. It was not much different then, really.
Mm-hmm.
It really wasn't. And theater is, you know, such an invaluable tool for awakening people, to inspire action. And we need action. I don't know what we're going to do, but we need action.
Yes. And in some ways, I think we are, to some extent, back in the 1930s in some ways. You're right about the divisiveness. That's nothing new in the American experience at all. People think about, say, someone like Franklin Roosevelt, FDR, and, you know, the tremendous affection, you know, and winning four terms as president and New Deal programs and so on. He was also one of the most hated men in America.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And not only by the right, but by the communists,
yes.
by the super left wing. And this was a real eye opener for me, because he, you know, in the eyes of the socialists and the communists, he was a collaborator with the capitalists.
Yes.
You know, he compromised. It was the big chance for revolution. They wanted revolution. And, you know, he did too, to a certain extent, but he was a little more realistic, you know, shall we say. But activism begins not, you know, the seeds of activism begin with idealism.
Mm-hmm.
And Clifford and the group theater, they were very young. I mean, he was in 1935, he was 29 years old, you know, and they were all in their 20s. And yet they were enormously powerful. They made lots of mistakes. They, you know, they, as so often happens with theater groups, they, you know, fostered the seeds of their own demise. But also the outside forces of the time, the outside forces of Broadway, you know, which is a capital, highly capitalist enterprise, as is the film world. You know, dictates destruction mm-hmm. of ideal. It's just a constant battle. And I do want to say that, you know, I am writing a full biography. I'm not just focusing on the plays, because he spent a tremendous amount of time in Hollywood.
I was about to mention that, yeah.
And, you know, he was reviled for that in many ways. But it also helped him grow as a craftsperson in particular. It also derailed him to a large extent. It's very, very complicated, just as those times were very complicated.
Yeah.
And as he was hailed as the playwright of the 30s, he was also emblematic of all the times that he lived in, you know, the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. He died in 1963.
The writer... in Hollywood, there have been lots of books about it. And certainly in Odets's time, in my subject's time, William Faulkner's time, going to Hollywood to many people was regarded as a sellout.
Absolutely.
You're writing for money. That, I know less about Odets, of course, but about Faulkner's, he never thought of himself as a sellout. He was there for the money, yes. But he wrote to the best of his ability in Hollywood. And in my biography, I tried to show, in fact, there were good aspects to him working with other writers and working on scripts that got mm-hmm. into his work as well, that there was a synergy there.
Oh, absolutely.
Most Faulkner biographers and most people at the time he worked with, I'm trying to think of his name, Faulkner worked with one writer, Joel Sayer, who left an unpublished memoir, and he's thinking about going to Hollywood, and he's saying, oh, I'm worried about it. Am I going to sell out? And the irony is he gets teamed with Faulkner, you know, and they write a good film.
The difference, however, is that Faulkner was not a major political figure.
No.
And Odets was.
That's
he was
right.
Snapped at the minute. You know, the minute Waiting for Lefty made such a splash,
yeah.
And then a month later, Awake and Sing, and then a month after that, the Group Theater picked up Waiting for Lefty, which yeah. had hitherto just been produced downtown, you know, independently of the group, although group actors participated in it. It had mostly been done by workers' theaters previously. When that hit Broadway, and Odets quickly wrote a curtain raiser for it because it did not provide a full evening of theater. And the curtain raiser was an extremely anti-Nazi play called Till the Day I Die. And, you know, what so many people don't know is that the United States was actually supportive of fascist governments. I mean, there's no other way to put it.
The American corporations were selling things like mad. Warner Brothers was the only film production, you know, company that pulled out of Germany. Most did not.
Absolutely. So,
yeah.
You know, Odets was one of the first people targeted by the, by the very first incarnations of the House Un-American Activities Committee, which,
yeah.
Actually in the 20s, the Red Scare. You know,
that's
J. Edgar
right.
Hoover was already on the loose.
Yep. Yeah, Odets is facing a whole set of pressures that Faulkner could come into Hollywood, in a sense, flying in under the radar.
Exactly.
You know, nobody noticing. And Clifford Odets couldn't do that.
Exactly. And Fitzgerald was able to do that. You know, poor Fitzgerald was not in good shape at the point that you know, he went to Hollywood and he was not happy about it, and it was not a positive experience for him. But, you know, Clifford's experience was a whole different kettle of fish. It's too much to go into now, but, you know, he had some, I consider his 1957 screenplay for Sweet Smell of Success, I consider in some ways the pinnacle of, and the, you know, not as a writer in general, the discipline, the dialogue is amazing. Now, yes, it was, you know, it was an adaptation, but he rewrote all the dialogue. And another difference between writing about playwrights and writing about, I mean, writing a biography of a playwright and writing a biography of a fiction writer or a poet is the performative aspect. Odette's, while he was writing, part of his writing process was he always acted out the parts. Always, from the very beginning. He knew no other way to do it. And Alexander McKendrick, in his memoir of working with Odette's on Sweet Smell of Success, talks about watching Odette's do rewrites, which he had to do literally on the spot, on the set. You know, Tony, there's a wonderful interview with Tony Curtis who talks about, you know, hearing the clackety clack of Odette's typewriter in the back of a truck while they were filming in the middle of the night in Manhattan. You know, Odette's rewriting a scene. And also Odette's generosity to other people, both in the material sense and the spiritual sense. It was almost universal. He didn't like hanging with other successful playwrights, especially when his career was on the wane. You know, there was a tremendous amount of jealousy, as there so often is. But Odette's in Hollywood, it was a very fraught experience for him. But he did, and he insisted that he gained, you know, a much better grasp of craft there. He didn't go to college. You know, he never had any formal training as a playwright. And it was very important for him. I mean, he had input in Rebel Without a Cause. You know, mm-hmm. He and Nick Ray were quite close from workers' theater days from the 30s. It's so tremendously interesting. And the scope is enormous. And my challenge is to whittle it down and yet incorporate it all somehow.
Yeah.
It's a big job.
Is there anything else I should have asked you or you want to say?
Yeah, I wanted, believe it or not, to quote Yoko Ono.
Okay.
When John Lennon, or at some point after John Lennon was shot, she said, "It takes more than a bullet to kill a man." And it, you know, with writers, and especially in my view, with playwrights, they don't die, you know, as long as they are produced, they're alive. Like my experience with the National American Asian Theater Company. It was so alive. It was so pertinent. It was so relevant. He's alive, and he deserves more of a stage. You know, I hope that Lincoln Center can get around to producing Paradise Lost, which was going to be next on their bucket. I don't know. You know, the theater world is kind of, I mean, the whole world is in turbulence, but
yeah.
COVID, you know, really threw a wrench into a lot of production schedules. But anyway, I hope my book will help foster more interest in this enormously seminal playwright.
What, yeah. what you say reminds me of what I think is true of a lot of biographies and biographers, certainly true of several of the biographies I've written. They're in a way reclamation projects or restitution or doing a kind of justice to your subject that you feel has not, people have not done and that needs to be done.
There's also a certain amount of, shall I say, defense that needs to be voiced in terms of Odette. The most controversial aspect of his life was his HUAC testimony. Wherein he named names. And that's, you know, no matter which way I go, you know, to paraphrase Elia Kazan's famous quote of a difficult decision means either way you go, you lose.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm going to be jumped on no matter what I say, no matter what, you know, my point of view is perceived to be. But I have to do it. And what I want to show is how difficult that time was. I mean, this could be a whole nother book.
Sure.
You know, it's too easy to judge. And that time was so painful and so difficult. I mean, there were a lot of suicides. Odette's was gray listed. He wasn't blacklisted, but he was gray listed, which in a way is like a slow choking of the artist rather than shutting them out.
Yeah,
it was a terrible time. And I hope to communicate that effectively. I really do. It's so important, especially in a time when so many people have never even heard of the House Un-American Activities Committee. And I kid you not.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
You know, or the difference between, you know, McCarthy and the House Committee, which...
Well, yeah, this goes back to an earlier point of yours and talking about the structure of Waiting for Lefty as a minstrel show. And I don't think people realize how pervasive, you were starting to say that. You know, one of my subjects, Sylvia Plath, went to high school in the 1940s and went to summer camps. They did minstrel shows.
Odette's
very popular form of entertainment.
Absolutely. He loved that form. He was, you know, a lot of people did this in the teens and the 20s. He was a counselor at Jewish, of course, camps, because camps were segregated in those days. And he was always the dramatics counselor, and he almost invariably put on a minstrel show. And I mean, with the whole, you know, nine yards, with the blackface and the shuffling and the whole stereotypical thing, which, you know, thank God, started going out of style when vaudeville was on the wane. And also as the Communist Party, as the socialist, became more accepted among, you know, certain factions. Because that, you know, it was egalitarian, and egalitarianism was seen as, you know, the way out of the chokehold of capitalism.
Well, all I can say is people, when they get to read your biography, are going to get a real cross section of the American experience.
That's the hardest part, is you know, in presenting that. And channeling that through his life. I mean, that's the nutshell version of the job at hand.
Well, that sounds like a good way to end, Beth.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Yes, we'll do this again when the book comes out.
I look forward to it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Have a good one.